Welcome back, Weekend Warriors. What a pleasure. I'm having so much fun.
By the way, this is Chicago playing in the background. They were influenced by ZZ Top during a period of their career.
I have my brother from another mother, the great Jeff Garland, who knows more about life. Because to make you laugh, you have to analyze life. Did I ever tell you the Sigmund Freud book that he wrote, Jokes in the Relation to the Unconscious?
No.
So in medical school at Columbia, as they tried to, they tried their best to expose me to OBGYN, so I delivered a baby. With Mrs. Rodriguez, a very nice Puerto Rican woman, 11 children. She's delivering her 12th child, my first rotation on OBGYN. You know, short staff, city hospital. Go in there. You have to deliver the baby. I just read about it. I'm only a third-year medical student. I don't know how to deliver a baby. Well, we need you. Go in there. Have my hat on sideways. I walk in, sweat is pouring. I can't believe I'm going to be delivering someone's baby. You can only read about it so much. And there's no one there really teaching me. So I sit down in the squat down. She's up in the stirrups. She could probably tell I'm a nervous wreck. So can the nurse. God bless Mrs. Rodriguez. She leans over the drapes, over her legs that are in the stirrups, and there I am, ready to deliver the baby, sitting on the stool. She leans over, she looks down at me, she goes, "Don't worry, Dr. Clapper. You're going to do just fine." She's delivering the baby. This is my life.
I used to go out with her. I'm just wondering if that was my baby.
But now I forgot why I was going to tell you the medical school story. All right.
Oh, definitely. No. It was the jokes and the...
Jokes and the relationship. So, right. So I'm now doing psychiatry, which, you know, macho surgeons, we don't want to even have anything to do with psychiatry, God forbid. But I fell in love with reading about this Meshuggah, Sigmund Freud, who was really brilliant. And I'm in the stacks one day in the psychiatry department, and I, of course, not reading what I'm supposed to be reading. I got distracted pretty quickly, like you would be.
Mm-hmm,
so I drifted to the Sigmund Freud section in the library, the psychiatry library. And there it was, a book written by Sigmund Freud called Jokes and Their Relation to the Unconscious. He wrote a treatise of why people laugh. You, as a comedian your whole life, you got to read this book. And it's not a big one. He keeps apologizing throughout the book because Sigmund Freud was Jewish. He apologized. I'm sorry, I'm going to use for an example another Jewish joke. But he does it and then he analyzes it. So what's the joke? You want to hear a joke from over 100 years ago?
Sure.
In those days, the funniest things people would talk about were matchmakers, which is kind of what you have now, dating service online and all the rest of it. But in those days, you paid money to a woman. And the wedding's on Saturday. You're going to meet your new bride on Wednesday. So this man pays all this money to the matchmaker. In Yiddish, they were called Schatchans, all right? And he uses that term because German, Yiddish, the same. So he pays the money to the Schatchan. He's in the living room of the matchmaker. He's paid all the money. The wedding's on Saturday. He's so excited. He's going to be meeting his bride for this Saturday. The wedding's all planned. He sits down on the couch. And all of a sudden, she says, "Okay, you ready? Here she comes." They open the door, and in walks this woman, hunched over, scoliosis bad, with a patch on her eye. Can't see out of one eye. The guy looks at the... He starts whispering to the matchmaker, "Hey, come over here. Quick, come over here." She says, "What's the matter?" He goes, "Are you kidding me? We're getting married. This is who you matched me up with? She can't see out of one eye, and she's hunched over. Are you kidding me? This can't be..." And the matchmaker looks at the man and says, "Sir, you don't have to whisper. She's also hard of hearing." And he then analyzes this matchmaker joke. Mm. So I need to introduce you to the great Sigmund Freud.
By the way, here's where I was going with the joke. He leans over to her. He leans over to the matchmaker and says, "How did you know?"
Exactly. Yeah. You know, you're funnier than Sigmund Freud. I love this. The great Jeff Garland. Let's listen.
Michael Jordan.
You're a Chicago, born in Chicago. Mm-hmm. You're a crazy Chicago Bears, Chicago Bulls fan, Chicago Cubs fan.
Ex-Chicago Bulls fan. I have completely and have been Clippers. I dropped the Bulls. The Bulls are run so poorly. I just said I don't have to punish myself anymore.
But you are the biggest Michael Jordan fan.
And Michael Jordan Bulls. Yes.
Okay. So let's listen to the fact that you must be, so I'm going to set it up that you of Pat Riley talking to Michael Jordan,
right,
which I played at 7 o'clock. We're going to hear it again, yeah, about family.
But what about this moment? I mean, that moment is a very profound moment.
This is when Michael Jordan gets the MVP award and starts crying.
Something behind what happened that night. I saw it with Irvin. Irvin, when he got his assist record, broke down. Dennis Rodman, when he won his Defensive Player of the Year award, unashamedly cried. And here, Michael Jordan wins the Most Valuable Player and sort of breaks up. And why?
This is Pat Riley interviewing Michael Jordan before he wins a ring. This is 1990, 30 years ago. And Michael Jordan trying to explain why it's a family. It's a family at work, which you, Jeff Garland, are an expert. Your whole beautiful career as a writer, producer, director, and actor, you're an expert in the family at work. And that's why I want to analyze the family at work in sports, in surgery, and in art and music.
This particular time, I was being given that MVP by my teammates, by people that I play with and I'm with 8 months out of the year, instead of the media, who I see, you know, quite a bit. But my players actually gave me that because of the way they played, I feel. and that was very touching for me. And when they said that they were going to go out there and help me receive this, you know, I did all I could just to hold back the tears, because it really showed to me what they really felt for me to win that award, and for them to go out there and receive it with me showed to me like it was a family situation. It was a unity all year long.
Michael Jordan's success is just that. He sees his teammates, my staff in my office, the staff I work with in the operating room, here on the radio station. It's got to be a surrogate family almost, and to some extent you can love them more than blood relatives. You're an expert in it. Let's listen to more about where it comes from in Michael Jordan.
And my family is pretty much hardworking. My mother, when I was young, had two jobs. My father had two jobs. He was the type of guy who was mechanically inclined. I learned the hard work ethics that he basically used to, you know, live our lives.
But who is it in his family that really motivated him the most? Is it his father? Actually, no. Who was it then?
My brother.
Your brother.
He's a year older than I. He's much smaller than I. And he was my challenge, my competition as a kid, mm-hmm, basketball-wise or sports-wise. He wanted to excel. I wanted to excel. We competed against each other in the backyard in basketball. We end up in fights, arguments, you know, about the sport. So my determination came trying to beat him. And if I could beat him, I could beat anybody.
Family for Michael Jordan.
I like to be known as just one of the guys, you know, just one of this team. We did this together. Michael didn't do it by himself. And when I'm with my teammates, I try to involve them in a lot of success that I've had. I mean, you know, we won the championship. I remember when Disney people came to me and say, well, could you do this? I'm going to Disneyland. You know, what would you do after you just won a championship? I'm going to Disneyland. And I said, I will not do it now unless you include the starting five, because I didn't do this by myself.
Where in art do we see the surrogate family, the family at work, where you have this sensibility? For me, in honor of Jeff Garland from Chicago originally, the band Chicago and their lead singer, Peter Cetera. This is what Peter Cetera sounded like when he sang with the band Chicago, when Michael Jordan's playing for the Chicago Bulls, the family at work. This is their first Grammy Award, 1976. Peter Cetera joins the band in 1967. So this, almost 10 years later, leads to this Grammy Awards song, one of their most famous songs. And he's singing. He writes, he produces, he does everything. But one day he wakes up and realizes, I want people to know who Peter Cetera is. I'm going to leave the band. This is the very first song he gets recognized with. This is in 1986 for the movie The Karate Kid. There's no Chicago band. It's just Peter Cetera. Funny, it sounds just like Peter Cetera in Chicago. People would ask him, why would you leave the band to do this when you sound just like the band Chicago? Well, contrary to Michael Jordan, he wants to be seen for who he is and not as the band. Where did his love for music come from? But before we get into that, you should hear, this is an interview he has with a Canadian radio station where they ask him, why would you want to leave to sound just like you did before with the band?
That's what you felt, huh? Did you listen to the rest of the album? That's my sound. Why would I not take that with me? I mean, why would I leave something that is so great like that and just leave it? I mean, that's me. That's like, you know, saying, well, I'm growing on my own, but even though I do this so well, I'm not going to do that anymore. You know, I mean, I take with me what is mine, and that's, on the contrary, people should have said, oh my God, look at Glory of Love, but that's you, isn't it? That's not, nobody else had anything to do with that. I mean, it's not Chicago, not David Foster or anything. That's Peter Cetera trademark. And then once into the album, you would have seen that there's a little bit, you know, there's a harder, you know, raw rock and roll stuff on the album also. It just so happens, you know, when you have hits with ballads like I've had, people tend to think that that's all you do, you know, as opposed to when you listen to the album, you realize that there's more than just two ballads on it, you know, because I wanted to do it with myself. I wanted people to know that was me, that wasn't Chicago, that wasn't David Foster, that wasn't anybody else, that was Peter Cetera. And if I continued doing those songs with Chicago, they would never know that, would they? I think there comes a time in, well, there came a time in my life when I just went, hey, listen, I've been doing this for so long, and nobody knows that I do this. Wouldn't it be nice if somebody knew that I, Peter Cetera, did this? And when that song came out, you know, I told somebody else the story before that I live up in Idaho in the local radio station, and I heard this because I was up there when the single came out. They played Glory of Love, and they said, and that's the new single by Chicago. And some friends of mine said, would you call those dinks up and tell them that? I said, no, it'll. By the second week, they said, and that was the new single by Pete Satori. My friend said, would you call those jerks up and tell them that I said, no. Third week, it was, that's the new single by Pete Cetera. Finally, by the fourth week, they said, and that's the new single by Peter Cetera on his Solitude Solitaire. I mean, you know, I wasn't about to go and say, yes, my name is Peter Cetera, and I'm a local here. People were calling up for me. It was quite funny. So I just think that's basically, you know, in a nutshell, what I'm kind of fighting, you know, is like getting people to know, you know, who I am, what I sound like, and what I do, and I just happen to write great love songs, you know, and that's nothing to be ashamed of, and if it sounds like somebody else, it sounds like me.
You know, what's interesting to me is I think he's actually more fascinated by the songwriting than the singing. And that may be why he left. Listen to his own daughter goes into the business, and listen to him talk about he gets more of a kick out of the songwriting than the singing, even though he has this incredible voice.
She just called me up the other day, and she said, God, I just wrote the first thing I really ever liked with this guy, you know, with this song. And she played me the song, and it was really awesome. It was and I could just hear in her voice. I said, I think you finally got it, you know, because there's that magic of when you write a song, nothing better. There's nothing better than that. Oh my goodness, I like this, you know. There's nothing better. The recording process or the playing or the you know, it's about the last thing for me on the scale of what I like the best is, you know, the writing of it, then the recording, and then the actual live performance of it, you know.
Yeah.
In order of what's the most exciting to me.
That may be the answer. Jeff Garland, coming up next, I want to talk to you about that. That maybe Peter Cetera, you can analyze this better than anybody else, it's in the songwriting more than singing the song. He has two gifts, And he prefers the first gift of songwriting. How interesting. We'll get into it with my guest in studio, the great Jeff Garlin. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warriors show here on ESPN LA 710. Welcome back, Weekend Warriors.
By the way, that's Peter Cetera in Chicago during their classic years. I think the name of the song is Question 67 and 69, yeah, or 68. I think that's what it's called. But doesn't matter anyhow. That's Robert Lamb, one of the other primary songwriters, the other singing back and forth. But they were a really original, beautiful band, I feel.
So I'll play again the soundbite of Peter Cetera quelling. Mm-hmm. It's a French word, over his daughter, who's going into the very field that he's in, about songwriting, not song singing, which is what we associate him being out there hearing his voice. But actually, his love is the creation of the song.
She just called me up the other day, and she said, "God, I just wrote the first thing I really ever liked with this guy, you know, with this song." And she played me the song, and it was really awesome. It was and I could just hear in her voice. I said, I think you finally got it, you know, because there's that magic of when you write a song, nothing better. There's nothing better than that. Oh my goodness, I like this, you know. There's nothing better. The recording process or the playing or the you know, it's about the last thing for me on the scale of what I like the best is. You know, the writing of it, then the recording, and then the actual live performance of it, you know.
Yeah.
In order of what's the most exciting to me.
What are your thoughts about that,
Jeff? I'm not going to go see him in concert. That's the least exciting to him. Well, there's great joy in writing. And what he wanted, which I understand.
Tell me.
Because I go through this too. I'm part of a family on Curb Your Enthusiasm. Right. And Larry David is the primary visionary on Curb Your Enthusiasm. Not me. Mm-hmm. Which I'm good with. That's what I signed up for. Is that he wanted to write a Peter Cetera song that Peter Cetera sang and Peter Cetera got credit for. If he's writing that song in the band Chicago, every person who plays an instrument has an opinion on how their thing should be. And he didn't want that anymore.
How interesting.
Yeah. And
does he become happier as the solo artist versus being in the band? You're an expert in this, Jeff Garlin. Who's the real audience? I just love magic, for example, that the trick they're showing you is in their left hand, but actually, you better pay attention to their right hand because that's where the rabbit is that they're going to pull out.
Right.
When an entertainer goes on that stage and sings Peter Cetera, the beautiful song, who's the audience? Is it Peter Cetera's inner being the audience of one, or is it the 60,000 people in the stadium?
Always the 60,000 people in the stadium. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, why even write it?
But don't you have to make the inner guy happy, too?
Well, by the way, you know, you say that. There are times where I go up on stage, and I got to tell you, I don't have it. But the audience laughs at everything I say. And I can say they're wrong, you know, because there's nights where I go up and I got it. Mm-hmm. And they stare at me. So,
and you don't care.
And I don't care because I know I got the groove going. But the point of the whole thing, though, is to communicate, either through song, through comedy, to where I do or say something that gets a positive reaction from someone sitting in the audience. So who's the audience? The audience is the audience. Even if they're right or wrong, they're the audience.
Do you see the front row, fifth row individual laughing? Or do you feel the energy of a mob?
Okay. Generally, it's a mob feeling. But when you're not doing well is when you notice the individual. I have said to people, oh, you're the one person who's really enjoying themselves tonight. I have said that, and that's true. So you don't really notice the individuals unless everybody else isn't laughing. And also the flip of that is, this is classic stuff. This is classic comedian mentality. So you'll be destroying in one person in the front row not having a good time. Who do you think you obsess about? That one person. There's this joke about a beautiful woman goes up to a comedian after his shows on a Friday, Saturday, after she saw him the night before. I saw you the night before, last night. You were fantastic. I got to tell you, I've never laughed so hard, never enjoyed myself. I'm going to have sex with you, and it will be the best sex you've ever had. I'm going to do everything you've ever dreamed of. How's that? And the comedian says to her, "Do you see the early show or the late show?" Because if she saw the show where you're not good, she ain't worth her time. That's a classic comedian joke.
One of the things I love about getting older is, as a surgeon, you just have to tell me your shoulder hurts. I can listen to your story. I can examine you. And it's as though, like a sculptor seeing the figure trapped in the stone, I can feel your skin. I can feel your acromion, your AC joint, your clavicle, the proximal humerus, your deltoid, your pec major, your trapezius. And it's as though my fingers take me through your skin and I can see the inside of the joint. It's a sixth sense.
So let me ask you a question. How often is the MRI different from what you thought?
Always.
Well, look at that. Really?
And it's because, first of all, we live in 2019. I don't need to remind you of that.
Yes.
The MRI is still in black and white.
Right. It's
Can you imagine?
Fact. There's no arguing with the MRI.
It's black. No, but it's black and white. It's like me watching the Goldbergs or Curb Your Enthusiasm black and white TV. Are you kidding me?
But isn't
you
don't black think we and white have... easier to notice the nuances?
No. Color is? I take a scalpel. I open you up. I've got to go, well, it was black and white, and now it's in living color.
That's so funny. It's so funny. You would think of that. I would never think of that. We just accept what the X-ray looks like.
X-ray, CAT scan, MRI, the black and white.
We accept that.
So the poor radiologist has to tell me, the surgeon, I see a shade of gray. That could be edema. That could be a partial tear. That could be in gray. Thank you. This is the genius has to tell me in gray. How about NASA, JPL, somebody make the CAT scan or the MRI in color?
Wow, that's wild.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
So when you ask me, well, is the MRI always right? It's predicated by being wrong because it's in black and white and not color. So from the get-go, it's not accurate.
Wow.
Isn't that cool?
Wow.
This is the way my Meshuggah mind works. But it's interesting to me. So here's what I would like to ask you.
Yes.
Riddle me this, Batman.
Do you know I do Adam West? Did I do him for you?
No, but I sat next to him at DuParts once, and he says, I'll have the butter on the side. I said to my daughter, Batman is here.
He saw me twice do an impression of him. The first time he came up to me afterwards and said, you are very talented. Good luck to you. Really, good luck. And the second time, I was on a radio show with him years later, and he said, that is the worst impression of me that I have ever heard. And I laughed so hard when he said that. Yeah.
There is no other Batman.
Commissioner Gordon. Yeah.
Oh, he was the best.
Yeah.
Because he, when you read about him and his relationship with Batman, unlike George Reeves, who ultimately couldn't handle little kids going, you're Superman. Nope, I'm a Shakespearean actor. I don't want to be just seen as that.
Right.
Adam West, God bless the guy, loved being a great actor who was Batman.
Yeah, he loved dressing up. I enjoy so much. Going out and talking to the Gothamites day by day. Chief O'Hara, I'll be in your office shortly. I'm at an autograph show.
I think you have to be my age, though, to remember the old
days. Yeah, but
that's okay.
Yeah,
today, I am the audience. It doesn't matter that everybody else is listening. All right, we'll take a break.
What was the question you were going to ask me?
I'm going to ask you about the sixth sense, what I know as a surgeon. Whether you're an electrician, a plumber, IT, you do your job 10,000 times, 10,000 moments.
Oh.
You see through the skin. I can't wait to ask you about
great.
Your
I look
world.
Forward to it.
All right, coming up next, the number's 877-710-ESPN. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warriors Show with my guest, Jeff Garland. Who are we listening to?
Chicago, doing Free, and that's Terry Kath singing in the background with Peter Cetera and Robert Lamb. They're all singing on this one.
Well, this is interesting because this doesn't sound like the other
Because this
they
is
make.
A band.
Uh-huh.
This is not. Later on, it became singles with Peter Cetera singing.
Got it.
And then later on, it became when what's-his-name came in to produce, it became...
David Foster.
It really became a Peter Cetera solo band.
Got it.
I'm sure the other guys didn't feel good. There might have even been a relief when he left. I don't know.
Interesting.
But they never reached the heights again that with Peter Cetera that they had. But to me, everything is about with comedy, with being a doctor, with a band. You just keep doing what you're doing, the way you do it, and grow. And the journey is the journey. You can't control. I can't control whether I'm on a TV show, number one box office comedian, whether I'm stand-up of the year, stand-up no one pays attention to. I just got to do what I do, and whatever happens, happens on the journey. All you can control is your approach to the work. That's all you can control.
All right. It's a Staples Center. Sold out to see Jeff Garland stand-up comedy.
Which happens weekly.
Okay.
Please come see me every Saturday night at the Staples Center for my weekly show.
After all these years, Jeff Garland.
Yeah.
Can you describe the sixth sense of coming on the stage and in 3 seconds, 5 seconds... You already know how the night's going to go.
Which is really, here's where it comes to. How bad will it be? And how great will it be is the nuance. I come out knowing, not going to be fun. This is going to be work. It's never bad.
Right.
It's just a lot of work some nights, and it's not joyful. And I've got to be a craftsman, because that will get me through the night. But when I come out and it's a good crowd and I feel good, then the only question is, how good is tonight going to be? Is it going to be great? Is it going to be an all-timer for me? I lucked out. You know, everyone makes comedy specials now. You know, it used to be when I was a young comic, they did like HBO did one a month. Maybe Showtime did one or two. There weren't many. You know, there were less than 18 a year, for sure, okay, total. Now there's 18 a month. So a lot of people, it's an ego thing. Oh, we're giving you a special. Oh, I'm going to go out and do my stand-up. I worked 3 years on my special that is coming out, I believe, in January. Might come out sooner. But here's what happens. I go out. I do two shows in one night. First show, I get everything. I worked hard, and I'm like, good, I got it. Second show, I captured lightning in a bottle. I was as good as I can be. The audience was as good as they could be, and I went on a journey, and it was captured.
Wow.
The number of nights that I did that in a comedy club and nobody knew, well, it's captured now. Now I have, for people to see, what it is exactly makes me special in what I do. And that is truly lightning in a bottle because it's so hard to do it on a given night, let alone to do it the night you're filming. I'm in shock and I'm so thrilled beyond
belief.
Can't
wait to see it. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
You know, in the operating room, a lot of people come to watch me do surgery because I do so many of them. And my pleasure to teach while I'm doing the
surgery.
Without
a doubt,
So when you have bone on bone and you're limping and your hip is awful, one of the things you have to do as the surgeon is remove the destroyed cartilage from the socket of the ball and socket joint with a tool. It looks like a cheese grater that's shaped as a hemisphere. It's called a reamer. And I
collect reamers throughout history.
And I love teaching the young surgeon. When I pick up this reamer to work on this person's cartilage to prepare it for the hip replacement, the new prosthesis, the new ball and socket joint. When I pick it up, I have to ask two questions. One, how sharp is this tool? Because they're just handing it to me.
Right.
Is it a brand new tool? Or is it one that's been in the box for a while and been used a lot and it's dull. It's not very sharp like a brand new one. Because if it's a brand new one, It will cut right through the cartilage into the bone and sometimes go further than I'd like it to be. That's the first question. How sharp is the tool? Here's the second question I have to ask. How soft is this person's bone? Because if this is an African American, because of the way the density of the bone is in that genetic makeup, it tends to be denser and harder for both African American men and women. It's a unique thing for us as orthopedic surgeons because we're dealing with tougher bone. One of the great things about being obese sometimes, by the way, is you're carrying more weight, you're loading your bone more, you actually have less chance of osteoporosis. It's really interesting. You don't have soft bone. You actually have hard bone.
So I've done my work.
You've done a beautiful job.
Yeah, now
Colin.
That I'm not so fat, I did my work, my heavy lifting already, as they say.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I don't know how soft lack of mineral calcium is in your bone when I open you up. I cannot tell that until I start to feel it and work on it. So how sharp is my reamer? How soft is the bone? Those are the two things. And if you don't appreciate one or the other, you can actually go too deep into the bone and create problems, and you can't put it back on. This is why I love sculpting in marble. Once I chisel away room for the nose or the lips, and you go too far, you can't put it back on again, which is what I love about the challenge of, I tell people, I work in stone and bone. That challenge is very similar to what I'm doing as a surgeon. But for you as the comedian is the two things you have to ask yourself. How am I, Jeff Garland, doing tonight? And how is the audience?
Without a doubt.
Those are the two questions.
And by the way, the audience is
only
made,
here, by the way, would I compare a hip replacement to doing a comedy show?
No,
with your,
but it's true. And let me also say, the audience is made up of, like you're saying, African Americans, you know.
Right.
Forget even that. Throw that aside. The audience is made up of their DNA, the way they were raised, where they were raised, what's their education, what's their job like, what's their love life like, how are they exercising? Oh, did they eat right today? Too much sugar. They're tired. They're this. And then it's all thrown together to create one single entity.
Wow.
So what are the odds that night that everyone's at the top of their game? Not very good. And what are the odds that night that they're all at the bottom of their game? Pretty gosh darn good. So the odds are more are against a great audience to begin with, because life is hard.
I didn't come from a rich family. I had to put myself through college and medical school, so I worked in the Catskill Mountains, right, upstate New York. I used to hitchhike because I didn't have a driver's license. I was too young. And I would go to work as a waiter, busboy, lifeguard. I did everything I could. And one of the jobs that I used to do was work as a waiter in the nightclubs at night in the Catskill Mountains. And I saw Freddie Roman.
I was about to say, for the first name, I was going to go Freddie Roman.
Freddie Roman.
A nice man.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I got to see them all in their Catskill Mountain days.
Right.
And I used to love the journey you talk about. They would get up on the stage, and it would be the taxi driver union, the teachers union, the plumbers union. And they would begin by throwing out a religious joke, a sex joke, a political joke. And like my EKG that I have to read for how your heart is working, for the spike to see with us. And they go, okay, they want to hear politics. We're going to do jokes on politics. They want to hear, you know.
But by the way, that's more of a craftsman.
Yeah.
Okay. You go on instincts. They don't go on instincts. I'm comparing you to a comedian.
Right.
Those types of comedians, I can't do that. But I do something they can't do. I walk out and just start. And I discover through what I am, what it is. And when I say I go to a craftsman, it just sort of, I get more, being a craftsman to me in what I do means I do what I have to do to get through the show. And it's not joyful. If I'm having a great time, oh, the levels that I can hit. It's so much fun. And it's more fun for the audience. So I don't have the luxury of throwing out the sex joke and then testing them and saying, oh, here's where I'm going to go tonight. I have nothing.
Hmm.
You know, I don't have that. I go, I am 100% instinctual. And there are people to varying degrees. I don't know many that do what I do. You know, there's a few that can do it, you know. And by the way, that's just the way I am and who I am.
Right.
It doesn't mean that I'm better or worse, because there are very funny people who are also great craftsmen, and they know how to do that, you know. I just do what I do, and I embrace it. I live and die by my sword, like a chocolatier.
You know, I have not even taken a single caller, and I apologize. I'm going to give the number out again. It's 877-710-ESPN. And in preparation to you being on the show, I knew what a great Chicago Cubs fan you are.
That for sure.
I watched black and white footage of the home run derby of Mickey Mantle going up against the greatest Chicago Cub
Ernie Banks.
And I want to talk to you coming up next about Ernie Banks and Jeff Gordon.
And I want to talk to you about that episode of Home Run Derby.
Okay. I can't wait to talk to you. The number is 877-710-ESPN. Welcome back, Weekend Warriors. So much
now,
fun.
Singing right now is Robert Lamb, the piano player who wrote this song.
Wow.
So, and this was a big hit. But this is before. This is when they were a band.
Before
not Peter
David
Cetera.
Foster made
yeah.
them into.
Well, David, Peter Cetera did start singing more of the hits later on. All of them, actually, like a lot of the songs Peter Cetera sang. But they were a band. Then the David Foster thing. It's really the Peter Cetera band. I mean, the way you
You're
know.
Right. That's yeah. what ruins it. That's what ruins it.
Yeah.
I love that he's excited that his daughter wants to be a songwriter.
Oh, by the way, I want both my boys to go into comedy. I only wish. And I know so many comedians who want their kids to do anything but comedy. I'm like, I don't get that attitude. I don't get it. It's a joyful, I mean, and also to love what you do. Come on.
Exactly. All right, quickly, let's take Michael in Huntington Beach. Michael, welcome to the Weekend Warriors Show with Jeff Garland, Dr. Clapper.
Hi, I've been enjoying the show. I thought maybe you were on vacation because when I called, the phone was busy. But I saw Peter Cetera last year, and I'm a ballad singer myself. And I was so proud of how he talks about his daughter. And he was saying how when he writes all these songs for movies, they take about 2 out of 10. And he works his butt off to do it. But let me give you a little song that we did for our wedding, okay?
Yeah, why not?
As time goes by, I realize just what you mean to me. There you go.
By the way, that song is Color My World, of which Peter Cetera told me that Terry Kath, who sang that song, sang it laying down on a couch.
Wow.
That's how they got that performance.
That song's only about 2 minutes and 12 seconds long, so it was perfect for our wedding. But I actually stole it from a friend's wedding because it choked me up so much.
Well, it's a beautiful song. But the man was laying on a couch singing that song. That's how they recorded it.
Well, Michael, thanks for checking in.
Yeah, thanks for the good times, and I always listen when I'm at work.
All right, well, I appreciate it very much. And thanks for all of you listening and telling all your friends. Tell me about Ernie Banks and Mickey Mantle and Home Run Derby. We got a couple of minutes.
And what about hot dogs?
Okay, the best place in L.A. to eat a hot dog, your philosophy.
Okay, my philosophy is this. Best place to get a Chicago hot dog in L.A. is to go to LAX, get on a plane, go to Chicago and get a hot dog. If you want a good hot dog in L.A.,
yes.
You go to Carney's.
Yes.
You go to Pink's.
Yes.
And you will have a great hot dog.
Yeah.
It's not a Chicago hot dog, but it's a great hot dog. It's a great L.A. hot dog. That's what you do. I've been to places here that serve the, quote, Chicago hot dog. But you got to go to Chicago.
It's like pizza for a New Yorker like me.
Yeah,
you got your own set of pizza.
All right, by the way, I prefer New York pizza. But deep dish is unique to Chicago. They try opening places here and everywhere. No, you go to Lou Malnati's in Chicago. That's it. Okay. Ernie Banks. Was, first off, that show, Home Run Derby, was filmed at Wrigley Field.
Oh.
And when you say Wrigley Field, you think I'm saying Chicago. I'm talking South Central L.A. There was a Wrigley Field owned by Mr. Wrigley in the 60s and the 50s and the 40s. They filmed a lot of TV shows there. Mr. Ed was filmed there in movies. Capra, I think, filmed there a movie. And so they used to have this. It was a smaller kind of version of Wrigley Field. Cubs minor league team played there. Then the Angels played there. And Yeah, they'd have Mickey Mantle versus Ernie Banks. Ernie Banks, who was my dad's favorite player, so obviously as a kid. And he was still playing when I was a kid. So it was so exciting to be anywhere, you know, Ernie Banks. It's just like, and then I got to get to know him later in his life. He had such a curiosity with people. First off, his patented question was, how's your wife? How's your girlfriend? He asked everybody that, no matter what. Hey, how's your wife? Hi, Ernie. How's your wife? How's your girlfriend? And then one day I was with him, and he was asking everyone, you a vegetarian? What's that like? You like that? I might be a vegetarian. This is an older man. I also hosted his 80th birthday party. To be anywhere near Ernie Banks, I shared a locker with him at the Celebrity All-Star Game in San Francisco one year. And up on top, I sent my dad a picture. It said Garland and Banks. No, Banks and Garland. Let's make it appropriate. I don't remember, but that's what I'm imagining. The man was wonderful, as far as I'm concerned.
You have brightened everyone's world for these last 2 hours.
And so has Ernie Banks for me.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Next week, the great Fred Dreyer. I can talk another two hours with you.
Fred Dreyer. Wow, that's as great as it gets,
man. We're
going
to go from comedy to sports, just like we do every Saturday.
Ask him about the hash marks. He doesn't like the new hash marks.
I'm going to ask him about that, thanks to Jeff Garland. Thank you, Jeff, for waking
up
early
with us. Thank you,
sir.
And I do want to apologize to all your listeners who wanted to hear more insight into Ernie Banks as opposed to my history with Ernie Banks, which is what I went for. Ernie was the best.
Thank you so much. He loves Chicago. We love him, the great Jeff Garland. Coming up next, you're going to be hearing all about the Rams playing the Raiders in the preseason. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warriors Show here
with Dr. Robert Klepper, certified board surgeon
on ESPN LA 710.